Hey, everybody. My name is Sarah Krieger. I'm an emergency physician and intensivist at UCLA, and this is the ICU EDU podcast. We're going to talk about the physiologically difficult airway. Now, this is almost certainly not the first or second or maybe even third talk you've heard about the physiologically difficult airway, but I think it's a really important thing that we need to be talking about and thinking about on a regular basis, because the physiologically difficult airway is what I call a trajectory-setting moment. So what we do in the emergency department and the ICU matters, and there's a lot of little things that we do that matter, but there are also these moments, these events that I think of as the trajectory setting moments, where what you do during that event can determine the trajectory of not just the patient's hospital course, but sometimes the rest of their life. It can make the difference between them, you know, maybe getting admitted to the floor for a couple of days versus a 3-month stay in the ICU versus maybe them just straight up coding in the ED. And we, as resuscitationists, need to identify those moments and spend a disproportionate amount of our time talking about them and thinking about them so that when they come up, we can execute them as perfectly as possible. Now, the physiologically difficult airway is not nearly as much fun to talk about as the anatomically difficult airway. Why? Well, partially, it's just not as cool. You know, when you're giving a talk on the anatomically difficult airway, you can show lots of cool pictures and everybody's like, wow, did it really look like that? The physiologically difficult airway, it's not nearly as cool. Especially because a well-done physiologically difficult airway should be very anticlimactic. If you're doing a complex physiologically difficult airway, and at the end, somebody's like, maybe one of the nurses or the techs is like, oh, that's it? That means you did it right. So if you do it right, it should seem very boring. Step zero with the physiologically difficult airway is deciding whether you actually need to intubate this patient in the first place. I remember feeling when I was a resident, like the sort of safety first, conservative intubation decision was just to intubate the patient. And feeling like, okay, if you see this patient and they're really struggling to breathe and you're watching them, the right thing to do was just intubate them as soon as possible. And to sort of sit there and watch them and delay intubation, that was the risky decision. That was the cowboy decision. But it turns out that's actually not the case. That safety first doesn't mean intubation first. And that sometimes going straight to intubation can actually be the more dangerous thing to do. And the first thing you have to ask yourself is this situation an emergency or is this an emergency? Because it's very rare that you actually need to intubate a patient immediately upon seeing them. It almost never happens. Now, every now and then, you just need to straight up intubate the patient as soon as possible. I mean, if my patient is projectile vomiting blood and obviously aspirating right in front of me, yeah, just intubate the patient. There are times that you need to do that. But much of the time, you actually have time. Much of the time, you can take 5 minutes, 10 minutes more to just think. And part of the art of the physiologically difficult airway is the art of thoughtfully doing nothing. We really like to do things in medicine. It makes us feel good. We like to do things for the sake of doing things, but doing nothing is difficult. And we need to make a distinction between being indecisive and just not knowing what to do and thinking carefully about a situation and deciding that the right thing to do is nothing. The physiologically difficult airway, I would say the most important skill in managing it is actually knowing when not to intubate the patient. It's a skill of not doing something. Why? Because of what I like to call the dyspnea masquerade. And this is where there's patients who would kind of look like you might really want to intubate them, but in fact, it may be a bad idea. And the problem with this is that all that shows up as dyspnea doesn't necessarily mean a problem that will be helped by intubation. Problems that will help by intubation are generally either problems with the lungs or the airway. And people who show up with dyspnea may have a lung or an airway problem, but often they do not. Now, part of what confounds this whole thing is that the drivers of subjective dyspnea and the drivers of what makes a patient look dyspneic are not necessarily lung problems. So firstly, hypoxemia, it turns out, is actually not a super strong driver of subjective dyspnea. We remember this from COVID, where we would have the patient and they'd be sitting 73 and we'd be looking at them and we'd be having a panic attack and the patient would be like, what? No, I feel fine. I'm not short of breath. But we also have studied this and see this in patients with COPD, with lung cancer, in palliative care patients, where hypoxemia does not appear to predict or really drive subjective dyspnea. So what does? What drives patients to show up and be like, I can't breathe? The four major things that tend to do that are: one, if they have an air movement problem; two, hypercapnia; three, acidemia; and four, shock. Now, air movement problems often can be lung problems. So these are patients who have problems with airway resistance or with lung compliance. Increased airway resistance or decreased lung compliance can both cause you to have issues with air movement. So these are the patients with asthma, COPD, with pulmonary fibrosis, with ARDS, where they show up and they're dyspneic because they just can't move air. Hypercapnia. Similarly, that is also a site driver of subjective dyspnea, and you can often see hypercapnia in patients with primary respiratory problems. But metabolic acidosis and shock are not primary lung problems. Your patient with a metabolic acidosis, they're going to show up and they're going to be complaining of dyspnea. Why? Not because there's anything wrong with their lungs, but because they are trying to compensate for their metabolic acidosis. It's like the DKA patients. They don't show up and say, I have DKA. They often show up and they say, I can't breathe. The patients with shock, often their shock has nothing to do with their respiratory status. I mean, sometimes if they're volume overloaded in cardiogenic shock, it might, but many of the types of shock shouldn't directly cause you to have a lung problem. They just cause you to be short of breath because the body's basically running an internal marathon. It's a physiologic stress which causes that sensation of shortness of breath. All of these things, both lung and non-lung problems, can cause somebody to show up looking like they're short of breath, saying they're short of breath, and that understandably causes you to think you need to intubate the patient. But the patients with a metabolic acidosis and shock, it's not going to fix anything. Intubation is not going to fix metabolic acidosis and shock. And not only is it not going to fix it, it could actually make it worse. Because intubation is a great way to set off a vicious cycle that can result in these patients deteriorating precipitously. Because when you intubate somebody, you're now causing hypotension, hypoxemia, hypercarbia, and then you're capping it all off with initiating positive pressure ventilation. And that vicious cycle right there, combined with their shock or metabolic acidosis, can cause them to fall apart. And there we find ourselves with the physiologically difficult airway. But if the right answer is, wait a minute, intubating them is not going to help their shock or metabolic acidosis and is only going to make my life difficult, do I really need to do it in the first place? Now, one of the issues that comes up is often patients who are in shock or have metabolic acidosis have altered mental status. And so I'll have residents come to me and be like, look, you know, I know that it's just that this patient is, you know, in DKA and that I shouldn't really intubate them because I get that's not going to fix the DKA, but their GCS is terrible and they're really, really, really altered. That gets me to one of my least favorite things in medicine, which is the GC8 equals intubate nonsense. Just because it rhymes doesn't mean it's true. Now, this idea of GCS having anything to do with intubation, there's no evidence that that ever was the case and that was ever something we should have been doing. But it's all something we've been taught for so long, and the rhyming thing, I think, just really sticks in our head. But fortunately, we're now having some evidence to prove to all of us that it was a dumb idea in the first place. So some of that is coming from trauma patients. So this was a study that came out in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery in 2021. And it was looking at patients with isolated traumatic brain injury and looking at whether we should routinely be intubating them for a GCS of 7 or 8. It was a retrospective study of like 2,700 some trauma patients with isolated head injury, GCS of 7 to 8. Bottom line with this study is that correcting for age, comorbidities, like head injury severity, and so forth and so on, what they found is that immediate intubation based on their GCS of 8 or less was independently associated with higher mortality with an odds ratio of 1.79. Now, there are definitely some issues with this study that I'm not going to get into now, and it, not to mention it was a retrospective study. That being said, there was certainly no signal of harm from not intubating these patients. I mean, it seemed like intubating them immediately was associated with them doing worse. But we now have a randomized controlled trial. So this was a study that just came out in JAMA in 2023. And it looked at patients with probably an acute overdose who came in with a GCS of 8 or less. So they randomized 225 patients with a GCS of 8 or less likely due to an overdose and randomized them to withholding intubation versus usual care. And the bottom line was they found that the intubation withholding group had fewer adverse events, including pneumonia. They had shorter hospital length of stay, shorter ICU length of stay, and didn't do worse in any way. This was a randomized controlled trial that withholding intubation based on GCS didn't seem to harm anybody. And I think this all tells us what we kind of already knew or should know, which is that mental status and airway protection are not the same thing. Are they correlational? Well, sure. Like, is a patient who has a GCS of 4 less likely to be protecting their airway than a patient with a GCS of 15? Yeah, of course. But they are not the same thing, because you can have a patient with a GCS of 4 who's protecting their airway perfectly fine, and then you can have a patient with a GCS of 15 who had a massive stroke last week and now is vomiting massively and can't clear their secretions and is not protecting their airway at all. Mental status and airway protection are not the same thing. And so just because your patient with metabolic acidosis or shock is tachypneic and obtunded, that may not mean that you need to intubate them right now. It may not be the safest thing to do. Just because their GCS isn't awesome doesn't mean that you need to intubate them, because it doesn't mean they're not necessarily protecting their airway. Okay, so we can all agree that intubating a patient for shock and or their metabolic acidosis is not something that makes sense. Trying to fix shock or metabolic acidosis with intubation is a futile exercise that will only do harm. However, it is the case that sometimes we are forced into intubating a patient with shock and or metabolic acidosis, because it won't fix their problem, but sometimes it's a thing that we need to do in these patients. When do you do that? When do you pull the trigger? When my patient really needs to be intubated, how do I decide that, okay, I know this is going to be a physiologically difficult airway, but it's something I need to do? Unfortunately, there's not a magic number. There's not a magic if their O2 sat is less than 92.5 or if their CO2 is greater than 43.7, I must intubate the patient. As usual, there's no magic number. But I do have an organized thought approach for how I decide, okay, this is somebody that I really need to intubate. And there's three major factors that help me determine whether I'm pulling the trigger to intubate a particular patient. The first is work of breathing. And by work of breathing, I don't mean respiratory rate. I mean, yes, respiratory rate's important, but what I really mean by work of breathing is accessory muscle use, because that can actually be much more important. And you can have patients who are tachypneic for all kinds of reasons, but with actually a not bad work of breathing. On the other hand, you can have a patient, for example, like Kussmaulling, who's really, really working to breathe, but their respiratory rate may not be all that bad. And so you can't just look at the number in the chart or have the nurse report to you that the respiratory rate is getting better or worse. You actually have to go to the bedside, look at the patient, what are they doing with their accessory muscle use? So what is their actual work of breathing like? The next question I ask myself, what is the reversibility timeline for their underlying shock or metabolic acidosis? Because if I have a patient who has DKA, let's say, and you know their potassium looks good, I've already started the insulin drip, I feel like there's a pretty good chance that I can reverse or significantly improve their metabolic acidosis within a matter of hours. Certainly, it's not going to take me days as long as I'm doing it right. On the other hand, if I have a patient who is in septic shock, gram-negative bacteremia, and maybe an abdominal source of sepsis where they're having bowel ischemia and they have a metabolic acidosis because their lactate is a million, well, I can't necessarily reverse that in a matter of hours. That's going to take me a while to reverse. And so I make a very different calculation, because the thing that is pushing them to have this increasing work of breathing is not something I can fix in a short timeline. So that makes a difference to me as well. And then finally, overall trajectory. Are they coming in and they looked horrible and now they only look pretty bad? Or did they come in looking pretty bad and now they look horrible? What direction is their overall trajectory heading in, and what direction is their underlying condition heading in? And when we talk about their overall trajectory and their work of breathing, I think we need to be very clear about something, which is that work of breathing is not the same as tiring out. So I hear this all the time. You know, somebody will come to me and be like, yeah, I think we just got to intubate that patient because they're working really hard and they're tiring out. Okay. It is the case that intense work of breathing can lead to a patient tiring out, but increased work of breathing is not the same as the patient already being tired. Patients, especially your young, healthy patients, they can work really hard for a long time. We saw this again with COVID, where we'd have patients, and I think maybe more on the floor than the ED, but they'd be actually working pretty hard to breathe for a while, and we'd watch them do this for a couple days. Now, whether that was the right thing to do in COVID intubations is another question, but people can work pretty hard for a while. I mean, think about what you're doing when you're running a marathon. I mean, I can't run a marathon, but you know, the people who can are very impressive. And what are they doing? They're also working really hard with their diaphragm. People can work for a long time. And so just be aware that just because they're working hard doesn't mean that they're already tired, but it can lead to them being tired. And so if their trajectory of work of breathing is getting worse, or if their ABG is getting worse, you may need to think about, okay, maybe I now need to pull the trigger. So ABGs can be helpful here to help quantify. So especially because most of these patients, whether they have shock or just an isolated metabolic acidosis, will have some sort of metabolic acidosis. Often the bad shock patients do as well. And so what you can do is get an ABG and make sure that the patient is appropriately compensating for their metabolic acidosis. And remember, the rule for that is when appropriately compensated for an acute metabolic acidosis, the CO2 should equal the last two digits of the pH on an ABG. So if I have a patient with a pH of 7.24, a CO2 of 24, and a bicarb of 10, that patient has a metabolic acidosis. And because the CO2 is equal to the last two digits of the pH, that metabolic acidosis is compensated. Now, if I get an ABG 2 hours later and my bicarb is still 10, but now my CO2 is 50, okay, that is giving me a sign that I am in trouble and my patient's trajectory is pushing me in the direction of intubating them. Now, another question I ask myself when I'm thinking about pulling this trigger is, can I interrupt or improve that trajectory with BiPAP? Because BiPAP can be a wonderful thing in these patients because it buys you time. And it buys you time to do two things. One, treat the underlying problem. And two, prepare for intubation. Often patients who are working really hard to breathe, you just need time to fix the underlying problem. It's like with your DKA patient. You just need to give them some more time where they can, you know, work that hard to breathe. And then you need to treat their underlying condition and give them a bunch of insulin. So that's one of the things. But preparing for intubation in these patients is really important. This is not the kind of thing you want to do as a crash intubation. You want to very carefully prepare. So even if you know that you're going to end up intubating this patient, BiPAP can still help you because it can buy you the time that you need to get everything ready to make this a nice, calm, controlled, boring intubation instead of a very exciting intubation where the patient codes. So then you ask yourself, does the patient have a true BiPAP contraindication? And I go on a rant about this in the BiPAP talk. So I'm not going to go on the full rant here, but the rant is very similar to my rant about how mental status and airway protection are not the same thing. And the main contraindications to BiPAP are airway protection, not mental status. Because if my patient is really significantly altered, but they're protecting their airway, and especially if I think they're altered because their CO2 is high, I'll 100% put them on BiPAP because the BiPAP will help them blow off the CO2. It'll help break that vicious cycle of CO2 breathing altered mental status. And if they're protecting their airway, I feel very comfortable doing that. And I feel like it's probably a safer thing to do than doing a crash intubation of a sort of unstable patient. Now, what are the true contraindications for BiPAP? The most important ones are if you think they're going to aspirate. So if I have a patient who's vomiting, that's a hard stop, no. But if I have a patient that I'm really worried could start vomiting, so like if I have a patient, I had this the other day, a patient with a really, really bad metabolic acidosis. But unfortunately, he was clearly having some kind of abdominal sepsis. He wasn't really able to keep up with his respirations because his abdomen was so distended, but His abdomen was super distended. He had a bowel obstruction. He was nauseous. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm not putting that guy on BiPAP because he's going to vomit and aspirate. And the risk of that is too high. So to me, that is the true contraindication to BiPAP. But if your patient's a little bit altered, that's not a reason to not put them on BiPAP. Now, again, am I going to stick them on BiPAP and then shove them in the back corner in the ED and not check on them for the next 3 hours? Of course not. These are the patients that I'm monitoring very closely anyways, and I'm checking on them frequently. And I think as long as you're doing that, it's okay to do. But the other thing that you're not going to want to do is wait till the last minute. There's probably an optimal time window for doing this and basically waiting until you're like, oh, I guess we have to intubate the patient now. I'll just stick them on BiPAP right before I intubate them. That's not necessarily the best use of it either. If you do this earlier rather than later, if they're working hard but before they're decompensating to the point that you need to intubate them, that is going to be your optimal time window. So don't wait till the last minute. Can you use BiPAP early to buy you time? And buying time to prepare for intubation is really important because in physiologically difficult intubations are one of those times that the idea of being proactive, not reactive, is super important. And that's because of this vicious cycle pathophysiology of what happens during the physiologically difficult intubation. And anytime you have a vicious cycle pathophysiology, intervention-wise, what it means is that you have to intervene early because if you can prevent your patient from going down that vicious cycle, it's way better than trying to rescue them from it. Because once they're in it, it can be very hard to pull them out again. One approach that some people advocate for the physiologically difficult airway, is doing awake intubations first line. I personally don't tend to do that with most physiologically difficult airways. I will absolutely do that with patients who I think are going to have anatomically difficult airways, but I don't tend to do that with patients with physiologically difficult airways most of the time. Because one, it's just really challenging. In order to do a good awake intubation, there's a lot of moving pieces that have to come together smoothly. You need to be very comfortable. You need a team that's very comfortable. And you need a patient that's relatively calm and cooperative. And if you have a patient who their only problem is an anatomic problem with their airway and they're otherwise fine, you often can get that patient to be calm and cooperative. If you have a patient who has toxic metabolic encephalopathy, they're profoundly altered, they're in shock, they're hypotensive, they have a bad metabolic acidosis, often they're in extremis, and getting that patient to be calm and cooperative for you is just not in the cards. And the most important thing in these intubations is not necessarily to do a fancy awake intubation. What you should be doing is whatever you're most comfortable with so that you can do it as fast as possible. And if what that means to you is an awake intubation, more power to you. But if what that means to you is DL versus BL versus bougie, whatever it is that you're most comfortable with that you can do fastest, that is how I think you should generally approach the physiologically difficult airway. That's how you get the tube in. In terms of how are you resuscitating this patient? Well, finally, we're wrapping our heads around the idea of resuscitate before intubate, and that's great. But it's another one of those things that you got to be careful with, because if it rhymes, maybe it's true. And I think that resuscitate before intubate, yes, 100%. The problem is what people sometimes interpret that to mean is give massive amounts of fluids and then intubate the patient. And that is not what resuscitate before intubate means. What resuscitate before intubate means is that you need to rapidly initiate supportive treatment for the underlying cause of whatever is making the patient unstable. And sometimes that means give a bunch of fluids, but sometimes that means that giving a bunch of fluids would actually be harmful and problematic for that patient. We'll talk shortly about what resuscitate before intubate actually should mean in given patients and specific circumstances. But for the moment, you know, what it doesn't mean is give a ton of fluids. Another important thing in these patients is you cannot be fooled by a normal blood pressure. Respiratory distress is a very, very strong driver of sympathetic activation, right? The patient literally feels like they're running a marathon. They're sympathetically activated. And that sympathetic activation can mask hypotension. And so just because they're no more tensive now, wait for it, they won't be the moment that you take away their sympathetic activation. So don't be fooled by a normal blood pressure. They will get hypotensive much of the time the second you induce them. And this is why I like to have an arterial line in these patients whenever possible, because I like to manage that moment-to-moment hemodynamics, that there's no other way I can do that. And this is one of the times that BiPAP can buy you the time to place an arterial line. Because if you're doing a crash intubation, you don't have time to do that. But if you know you're heading towards a very scary intubation, this patient, and you use your BiPAP to buy you time to place an A-line to do it more safely, fantastic. The next thing that I have ready for all of these patients is pressors. And I have two kinds of pressors. I have one push dose pressors at bedside in my hand, in my pocket. Two, I have pressors in line, hooked up to the patient, not in theory on the other side of the room, because then when I need them, somebody's going to be like, but the brain's not working and we can't get the pump working and oh, now it won't connect. And wait, where's their IV? No. You need to have pressors that are going into the patient. They are connected. So usually I'll just be like, just start them at like 0.02, 0.03, like a little Levo at 0.02, 0.03. Even if the patient's blood pressure looks good, just to get them going and have them on board. But I have pressors ready for every single one of these patients. What about induction? So increasingly, it's seeming like ketamine may be the induction agent of choice for, I would say, the majority of patients with a physiologically difficult airway. Previously, I taught that, you know, all the problems with etomidate were just theoretical. This adrenal suppression thing, it was a theoretical thing that didn't have clinical significance. Turns out the evidence is bearing out. We were probably wrong, that actually etomidate is probably not a good idea. This was a paper that came out in Journal of Critical Care, Catani et al. In 2023. It was a meta-analysis of randomized trials looking at etomidate as an induction agent for endotracheal intubation, specifically in critically ill patients. And it was a meta-analysis of 2,700-some critically ill patients from 11 randomized controlled trials. And the punchline of this study is that they found increased mortality associated with etomidate with a really concerning number needed to harm of 31. That was really concerning to me. I was like, huh. Because even if, I don't know, they made some mistakes in statistical analysis and they actually, you know, overestimated the effect by half and the number needed to harm is actually 60, that's still really concerning to me. And so I think increasingly people are starting to be like, okay, maybe etomidate is not necessarily the best agent to use. Now, what about propofol? I feel like in the anesthesia world, a lot of people use propofol routinely for intubations. Our data on this is not quite as obvious. You know, there was a recent meta-analysis that came out in Critical Care also on propofol. But the problem with this meta-analysis is that even though it looked at like 30,000-some patients from over 200 randomized controlled trials, the problem was it wasn't just looking at critically ill patients and it wasn't just looking at induction. I was basically looking at propofol as an induction or sedation agent in any clinical setting. And so the fact that they found a slightly increased mortality associated with propofol use, I have no idea what that means. That being said, you know, for me with the physiologically difficult airway, I am not necessarily using propofol as my go-to. It can cause some significant hypotension. And yeah, I have pressors to balance that out. But if I have a good potential alternative that I can use, I'm probably going to go with that. And my good potential alternative here is ketamine. In the 2024 now, a study came out in Critical Care that specifically looked at ketamine versus etomidate as an induction agent for tracheal intubation in critically ill adults. And this was a meta-analysis of almost 3,000 patients from 7 randomly controlled trials and 1 propensity match study. And they did a Bayesian analysis that found a moderate probability that induction with ketamine was associated with a reduced risk of mortality compared to etomidate. To me, based on all of this, I feel like ketamine is generally going to be my go-to agent at the moment for most of my critically ill patients that need intubation. Is the evidence going to change? It might. And if the evidence changes, we will change with it. But at this point, I think ketamine is a solid, reasonable go-to over etomidate and for me over propofol. Okay, so that's my general approach to the physiologically difficult airway. Be proactive, not reactive. Intubate however is the fastest for you, whether that's VL or DL or bougie, not necessarily awake intubation. You're going to put an A-line in whenever possible, have pressors on the ready, and generally a ketamine induction is reasonable. Now let's get into a little more depth on this resuscitate before and while intubating part and talking about some of the specific details and specific instances of shock and metabolic acidosis and how you want to address them. So we're going to break this down first by talking about different categories of shock because they're not all the same. The first category of shock is shock that's due to things like hypovolemia, bleeding, or vasodilation, so septic shock, vasoplegia, any kind of vasodilatory shock. In patients who are in shock due to hypovolemia, sepsis, bleeding, in those patients, there's a couple key things. These are the patients that you do want to give them a ton of fluid versus a ton of blood before and during and after intubation. Norepi is a really, really good thing for these patients. Just start it before you intubate them. They're often hypotensive even before you intubate them. So start them on some Norepi and be aggressive with your Norepi during the intubation. And then keep in mind, positive pressure is not helping these patients. And if they start dropping their pressure immediately post-intubation, it might not have been your induction. It might be that you're being too aggressive with the bagging. So, you know, starting them on a gentle PEEP, being gentle with the bagging, because positive pressure is actually going to worsen their hemodynamics. So that's what you're going to do with patients who are in shock due to hypovolemia, sepsis, bleeding, vasoplegia, that cluster of patients. What about the cluster of patients who are in shock due to left-sided heart failure? In patients with shock due to left-sided heart failure, fluids are not helping you. Fluids are hurting you. Do not give them fluids. In fact, I will often try and diurese these patients before I have to intubate them, if I do have to intubate them, because diuresis will improve their hemodynamics. Fluids are not helping you in left-sided heart failure. In terms of what pressor I want on board, Norepi is a very reasonable thing to do. If I have a patient, though, who's either maybe on a beta blocker at baseline and they're inappropriately bradycardic, or maybe, their inotropy is really suffering and they're not tachycardic, sometimes I'll use epi. So I think either norepinephrine or epinephrine would be a reasonable pressor to have on board in these patients, and have it on board early, because again, you know, starting to give them a bunch of fluid mid-intubation is not going to help things at all. Finally, positive pressure in these guys is actually helpful. Unlike in the set of patients who are shocky due to hypovolemia, sepsis, and bleeding, in patients with left-sided heart failure, positive pressure can really help you. It's the same thing how we, you know, like give BiPAP to patients with SCAPE and to patients who are in left-sided heart failure with pulmonary edema. The positive pressure helps their hemodynamics. So often in these patients, even if they're not hypoxemic, I will start them on a PEEP of 8 to 10 just to help my hemodynamics. What about shock in patients who have pulmonary hypertension or right ventricular failure? So, in shock due to pulmonary hypertension or right ventricular failure, these patients can be terrifying to intubate. They tend to crash and burn when you intubate them. And so in addition to everything we talked about, being very careful about deciding, do you really need to intubate this patient in the first place? You got to be extremely careful how you do it. Issue number one is that fluids are harmful. The RV is, you know, not preload dependent. That is a myth. It is much more complicated than that. And in patients with pulmonary hypertension or any cause of increased afterload, including patients with a massive PE, fluids are harmful and can in fact cause the patient to start to fall apart before you even think about intubating them. Do not give them fluids. Two, pressors. Lots and lots of pressors here. So my first line in these guys tends to be epinephrine. In the right ventricular failure series, I talk about why. But norepi is also perfectly reasonable in these patients. I just personally prefer epi. I don't usually go vasopressin for my pressor that I'm using during intubation for these guys, because I want something that has a better titration range. Another thing I'll do for these guys specifically is I have them all on high-flow nasal cannula while I'm intubating. I have them on high-flow nasal cannula, partially to sort of oxygenate them, you know, apneic oxygenation and all of that during intubation. But also, I use it so I can give an inhaled pulmonary vasodilator during intubation. So if I have, you know, inhaled bupropion, I'll start that. If I don't, I'll start inhaled milrinone or inhaled nitroglycerin, and I'll have it going through my high-flow nasal cannula during intubation. If for some reason I can't do that, I'll give them a milrinone neb before I intubate them to try and prevent some of the deleterious effects of hypoxemia and hypercarbia on the pulmonary circulation, because that's part of why these patients fall apart, is that their pulmonary circulation does not like hypoxemia and hypercarbia. Now, once you get these guys intubated, your next problem is how do you deal with their vent settings? Because positive pressure is not actually helping these patients. You know, positive pressure can increase their pulmonary pressures, which is not helping you. But at the same time, you have to balance that with the fact that a lot of these patients have underlying lung disease. You know, because for a lot of them, that's why they have pulmonary hypertension in the first place. So sometimes what happens is you do need some PEEP. You do need some higher tidal volumes or whatever it is to optimize your respiratory mechanics and optimize your oxygenation and ventilation. And it seems like actually that's probably your first priority, that yes, you should try and minimize positive pressure, but not necessarily at the expense of having worsening respiratory mechanics and worsening oxygenation and ventilation. And so this can be a very careful dance in these patients. And this is certainly where I would make sure that I have your intensivist at bedside very early on. Okay, what about patients who are in shock because of tension pneumothorax or tamponade? So these patients are also very, very scary to intubate. And you should do everything within your power to attempt to decompress these patients first before you intubate them. Because if you don't, they're going to crash and burn. So do your very best to decompress them first. You should be giving them lots of fluid or blood or often both. Just pour the fluids into them. And you can have some norepi on board ready to go as well. But really what these patients need is volume. And then you got to keep in mind that positive pressure ventilation is disastrous for these patients for two reasons. One, it drops their preload. And the pathophysiology of both tension pneumothorax and tamponade are, that's what's going on, is that your preload is dropping. And so we're now adding insult to injury. But in the case of tension pneumothorax, it's actually worse than that, because not only is your positive pressure dropping your preload, it's actually making your tension pneumothorax way worse really fast. So if for some reason you can't decompress these patients first, be prepared to immediately decompress them after you've intubated them, because they're going to code. And when you're ventilating them, do not bag them aggressively. Do not put them on a bunch of PEEP, because that's going to make the whole situation worse. Okay, so those are the four different categories I think about in terms of patients with shock and how to deal with them. Patients with shock due to hypovolemia, sepsis, and bleeding is one category. Patients with shock due to left-sided heart failure is a second one. Patients with shock due to pulmonary hypertension and RV failure is a third one. And then patients with shock due to tension pneumothorax or tamponade is a fourth one. And those four categories of shock, I sort of need to treat differently in terms of how I'm managing their resuscitation during, before, after the physiologically difficult airway. What about the patients with metabolic acidosis? So patients with a bad metabolic acidosis are very scary to intubate. Why? Because the only thing that is maintaining their pH at values compatible with life is their ability to blow off their CO2. And if they have a bad metabolic acidosis and you lose that compensation, your CO2 starts climbing, and it doesn't even have to climb that much for that long, you can drop your pH precipitously to values that are no longer compatible with life. So that's why intubating these patients is scary. And that leads us to the core thing about intubating these patients, which is you gotta minimize apnea time. So when I'm intubating these patients, I'll generally do it with a BiPAP bridge. Unless I have a really good reason not to, I will usually put these patients on BiPAP before I intubate them. Try and make it safer to intubate them by making sure that their CO2 is as low as it can be before I try and intubate them. And then what I do is I just use my BiPAP as a bridge straight through to when I'm actually intubating them. So I keep them on the BiPAP. Then when I'm ready to push my meds, I put a rate on the BiPAP. Then I push my ketamine, I keep them on right on the BiPAP, and then I push my paralytic. And only then do I take off their BiPAP mask and put the tube in as quickly as possible. Now, one question I get asked about a lot on these patients is, should you add a sprinkle of bicarb? And the thing is that, I mean, you know, I'm not going to throw a hissy fit if you do add some bicarb, but I think the thing to keep in mind is that it probably isn't helping you. And it's probably not helping you for a couple of reasons. One, it's not actually helping fix your acidosis, almost certainly. But two, it's probably not helping you because if you're intubating these patients in the first place, you're probably being forced into it because they can't keep up with their CO2, because they can't blow off their CO2. And if they can't blow off their CO2, bicarb is useless to you, because how does bicarb work? Bicarb gets converted into CO2, and then you have to breathe that CO2 off to actually improve your pH. And if you push a bunch of bicarb, but they can't eliminate that CO2, all you have accomplished is converting your metabolic acidosis into a respiratory acidosis and changed your pH not at all. And so bicarb probably isn't helping you. That being said, you know, if you want to push them as a sort of bridge thing, like, you know, it's not going to fix the underlying acidosis, but you want to push it as a bridge to these patients, and it is a patient that they are keeping up with their CO2, or maybe you have them on BiPAP to help them do that, you know, it's not a crazy thing to do. It's just, don't get focused on that and miss the important things. And the important things are minimizing apnea time. Now, what that also means in these patients is that you got to bag between attempts. I think often we don't bag between attempts until the patient gets hypoxemic. But you must remember that the patient's CO2 is going to go up way before the O2 goes down. And so don't wait until the patient is hypoxemic, because by the time the patient's hypoxemic, their CO2 is already high. And if they have a metabolic acidosis on top of that, now your pH is in trouble. So don't do that like, no, I'm just going to take one more look. Bag between attempts, and bag aggressively between attempts. And then when you get your patient on that vent, don't put them on a rate of 16. This is a time for high minute ventilation. This is a time for tidal volumes of, you know, 8-9 cc's per kilo. This is a time for a respiratory rate of maybe 24 to 28. Keeping in mind that if you do that, you're going to need to have an eye time of like 0.7, 0.8. Give them aggressive minute ventilation on the vent, because now you need to compensate for them. And it's much harder to compensate and blow your CO2 down on a vent than it is when you're spontaneously breathing. So you got to really pay attention to it. So that is the physiologically difficult airway. Physiologically difficult airway, it can be a key trajectory setting moment for your patients. And you need to be very, very thoughtful about whether or not you actually need to intubate this patient, and make sure that we're not intubating patients for shock or metabolic acidosis, but we know how to intubate them if we're forced into intubating a patient with shock or metabolic acidosis. In terms of pulling the trigger to intubate, I think about three key things, which is, how's their work of breathing? What is the reversibility timeline for their underlying problem? And then what's their overall trajectory? Hopefully you can buy yourself some time with BiPAP. And when you get to the point of intubating, do whatever you're most comfortable and facile with to get that tube in as fast as possible. You're going to put in an A-line if you can, support their blood pressure with pressors. Ketamine is maybe your induction agent of choice. And then you're going to think about, what are the specific needs for their underlying cause of shock or metabolic acidosis? Thanks so much for listening.